Mountain Polyhedra, and it's based on a lot of work that has been done here at Perrin-Kjær Institute, and some more recent work I've been doing together with Al Agar from Berkeley, Pietro Donà from Pisa, and Simone Speziale, who was here at Perimeter and is now in Marseille, where I am. Before entering the technical part of the talk, I would like to tell you about the role quantum polyhedra play in quantum gravity, and what is my physical perspective on this role. To do this, let me go back to the seminal paper by Rovelli and Smolin of 94, where they studied the geometry of space at the Planck scale, and they find that in loop quantum gravity, this geometry has a granular structure with the grains of space that have a quantum behavior. These grains have a quantum volume and a quantum shape, and are associated to nodes of a graph. And what I discuss is the fact that these grains of space can be understood as quantum polyhedra. Their quantum volume can be understood as the volume of a polyhedron, the quantum volume of a polyhedron, and its shape as the quantum shape of the polyhedron. Or if you prefer, the classical limit of this quantum geometry of grains of space is classical Euclidean polyhedron. So this is the first preliminary hint that I wanted to say. The second is, this provides this is a feature of the theory. This provides an ultraviolet cutoff that is typical of loop quantum gravity. And the question is, when is this physically relevant? And to discuss this, I'd like to consider a scattering process. Now, you know, scattering theory is not a completely developed subject in loop quantum gravity. Still, it's very useful in order to put things in perspective. So here I'm considering the scattering of two particles with energy E, energy in the center of mass E, and impact parameter B. And I'm considering a phase diagram that I could draw for any theory of quantum gravity. And I'm identifying different regimes. So the regime one of low energy and large impact parameter is called the Born regime. And here we already have a good description in terms of perturbative field theory and graviton exchange. And the question here is, does loop quantum gravity admit an effective field theory description in this regime? Now, we have been working a lot on this. There are results about the two-point correlation functions and gravitons. There's still much to be done. The thing that I want to stress here is that this is important to assess the physical viability of the theory, but we don't expect here to see effects coming from this granular structure. And similarly, in this other regime, 3, where the starship radius associated with the energy of the process is much larger than the impact parameter. Yeah, in this regime, we expect production of large classical black holes, and the cross-section can be predicted using classical general relativity, as Cesar Gomez told us last week in his seminar. So the question again is, does loop quantum gravity reproduce classical general relativity in this regime? The place where genuine quantum geometry effects are expected to be important is this narrow wedge. And there's a proposal that I find promising, I find interesting by, it's recent, by Seth Mager, where it says the angle quantization that is a feature of loop quantum gravity, it has to do with these quantum properties of these grains of space, may show up in the angular distribution of cross sections at high energy. So, this has the potential to play a role similar to the one that Stern-Gerlach experiment has played for quantum mechanics. It's something that does not depend on a specific coupling of matter to gravity, just on a kinematical property and a feature of the theory. And then for loop quantum gravity, there's a fourth regime that has to do with our hope that loop quantum gravity provides an ultraviolet completion of graviton field theory, with the ultraviolet behavior being that there are no transplanckian degrees of freedom because of Planck scale gaps in the spectra of the area, for instance. We know that the area can be either zero or some finite Planck scale value. But still, the important aspect here is the volume. Is there a Planck scale volume gap? The issue is not completely settled. There's the opportunity to have this gap in quantum gravity. So I think it's important to go back to this and understand in detail if there is a volume gap. So I'll go back to this at some point in the talk from the point of view of quantum polyhedra. Okay, so this was my introduction. Now, the outline of the talk have three parts. The first part, I discuss spin network nodes as quantum polyhedra and tell you about the classical limit of this quantum geometry of Green's space. And then, once you have the classical limit, you can try to use it to learn something about the spectrum of the volume. This is my second part, and the third is about black hole entropy, where I use most of the ideas that I have introduced in the first two parts. Okay, so part one, the Hilbert space of states of loop quantum gravity. You consider a graph, you associate SU2 group elements to links of the graph, and consider functions of these group elements that are invariant under rotations of nodes of the graph. The space of these two functions is the graph Hilbert space, and the full Hilbert space of the theory is obtained a la Fock. So states are functions of these group elements, and the geometry interpretation comes from the momentum conjugate to the configuration. It is the derivative with respect to this group element. It is called the flux operator. So here, gamma is a dimensionless parameter, the inertia parameter, and L Planck as dimension of length. And these are to be understood as fundamental constants of the theory. The theory does not predict them. And J is the left derivative. And notice that this operator transforms as a vector. There's one of these for each link. Now, it is associated to the source of the link, and each one of them transforms as a vector under rotations at the node. So if you want a scalar, you take two links that share a node. You take the scalar product of these operators. This is a scalar, and this, in fact, was considered long ago by Penrose, the Penrose metric operator. So you have a set of these operators, and they do not commute. Okay? So you can consider a maximal set of commuting operators and look for simultaneous eigenstates of these operators. And this gives an orthonormal basis of the graph Hilbert space that is called spin network basis, with links of the graph labeled by representations of SU2 spins and nodes, that is what I'm going to discuss. So I'm reviewing the basis of loop quantum gravity here. So what happens at the nodes? So you have an Hilbert space associated to each node, and this is really, the Hilbert space of a very simple system is the system of F particles. If you have F links at node, F particles of spin J1, JF, and you are considering states that are invariant under rotation, singlet states. So these are the states, and the quantum geometry interpretation of these states comes from expectation values of this metric operator. Okay, so, well, Penrose considered the expectation values of this operator on states in this space, well, in fact, the rationalized operator. This defines a matrix, TLL prime, that is an F times F matrix, that doesn't have any specific property, but there's this interesting thing that goes under the name of Penrose spin geometry theorem, that is, if you consider states that have small dispersion of the metric operator, semi-classical states, then the expectation value of this metric on semi-classical states is a matrix with this specific property, is the scalar product of unit vectors in Euclidean space. So it measures the geometry of space. It measures the angle between directions. Okay? Now, in the proof of the theorem, there are a number of hypotheses, but there's no example of states of this kind. Now, in loop quantum gravity, we have these states. These are coherent intertwiners. The second thing that we have in loop quantum gravity that was not available here is the interpretation of the norm of this flux operator that is the area. So the question is, these semi-classical states that Sperus uses, they are picked on something with given areas and given directions. What is this classical object? And for the case F equal 4, we know it's a tetrahedron. And here I'm discussing the case with F larger than 4. And you may expect that it's a polyhedron with faces of given areas and normals. So I want to give some more details on this. So if you consider a normal, this identifies a plane and an half space. You can consider the intersection of half spaces, and this gives a convex polyhedron. So this convex polyhedron is defined in terms of these normals, and you are and these planes are at a certain distance from an origin. While the variables that I was discussing before are areas and normals, so the question is, can I use this data, areas and normals, with this closure condition to describe a polyhedron? In fact, one can start from this description with normals and then try to adjust the heights so that you get the area that you want. But it may happen that you don't find this area. Do you always find this polyhedron with this data? Does it exist? And even if you find one, there may be others. There may be smooth modifications that don't change this data. Is it rigid? I've been thinking about this problem for a while, so you can imagine my surprise. I was reading this account of the life of work of Hermann Minkowski, and it seems that when he was working on geometric number theory, he got interested exactly into this problem. And he actually solved it. He proved what is called the Minkowski theorem. There exists a unique convex polyhedron with this data. So in the proof, you don't have the way to reconstruct the shape. The first thing you may ask is, if I give areas and normals, how do I know if two faces are adjacent or not? Well, it's written into areas and normals. There's a reconstruction procedure. We have been looking at this. I'll give some examples later. Okay? So this was the first ingredient, that is, areas and normals give a space of shapes of polyhedron. The second ingredient is that this space of shapes is in a natural way a phase space. So I'm fixing the areas, and I'm looking at unit vectors that satisfy this condition up to rotations. And on this space, I can introduce these Poisson brackets, rotational invariant Poisson brackets. With this structure, this is a phase space. And it turns out that this was studied some 15 years ago by Kapovich and Milson for different reasons, with a different geometric construction. But the structure is the same, so we know that this is a phase space of tetrahedra, of polyhedra. Okay? And you can identify canonical variables in this phase space, the Qs and the Ps.
Yes, go ahead. Is that this is even dimensional?
Uh-huh. Yeah, you have to count. So there's invariance in the rotation. And this constraint. Uh-huh. And you find that the dimension is F minus 3 times 2. Okay? And become more clear when I give a couple of examples. Yes.
There's another one where the area.
Yeah, we are speaking about phase space or polyhedra with F faces, and each face has an area that is given. Okay? So the statement is convex polyhedra with F faces of given areas form a phase space of this dimension. And there's a series of beautiful works by Conradi and Fredel, Lili, Krasnov, about the fact that this. If you quantize this classical system, you get interplanar space and much more. You can start from the quantum theory, look at coherent states, and look at where they are pinned. Okay? So, examples. You see the first material case is F equal 4, the tetrahedron. So, you have the phase space, the Qs, periodicity 2 pi, and the Ps. Each point in this phase space is a shape of a tetrahedron. These curves are curves of constant volume, so when you move along this curve, the volume doesn't change, but the shape does. This is the one of maximum volume, and this is the parity related one. Okay? The second example that I want to discuss is
so F. Yes? Show our P and Q, your definition.
Yes. So the acoustic interpretation, the Q is the angle between opposite edges, and the P is the dihedral angle between two faces. And the definition is written here. Okay? So this is F equal 4. The second example that I want to discuss is F equal 6. There's a reason why I want to discuss it, is that in loop quantum gravity, there's an idea that has been explored that is, it may be that the relevance in classical states come from spin networks with nodes that are six valent, so that you get something that looks like a cubulation in space if you interpret each node as a cube. This was explored by Thomas Thiemann and also by Cecilia Flori, who's here. So let's look at the classical limit at the phase space for f equals 6. And in fact, we get points that correspond to cubes, and some lines here inside that correspond to objects with opposite parallel faces. But in general, this region is a cuboid. This is a six-dimensional phase space, so I'm taking a slice. But there is something that it's not a cuboid. There's something else. It's a polyhedron with six faces, two of them being pentagonal. So this is classical. When you go to the quantum theory, you have to expect that a state, the state of one of these grades of space, a state in interfinite space, is a superposition of the two. It's not one or the other. This is completely quantum. Then when you go to coherent states, from classical states, you can pick on one of them. And the idea of this series of works that started with Levin and Speziale, is exactly this one. You have a complete set of states in the space. It is built this way. You take a point in the space. This is a polyhedron. And you build a state that is determined by this point in the space in this way. Once you give the point, you know the polyhedron, you know the normals. So you can write coherent states for this direction, the spin pointing in that direction, the block coherent state as you do in nuclear theory. It is. And you can take the tensor product of them, and the rotational invariant component is an intertwine. And this defines the equivalent interfliers. Now, these states satisfy the hypothesis of Penrose spin geometry theorem and are picked on the geometry of classical polyhedron. This is for a single grain. And in a spin network, you have many of these grains with adiacent simulations. And it turns out that they reconstruct a geometry that has been studied by Fredel and Speziale. It's called the twisted geometry. And at the quantum level, you can write coherent states for this twisted geometry, this collection of polyhedra that is picked on the intrinsic and the extrinsic geometry. Okay. Something that I found surprising is that in loop quantum gravity, there's an old well-explored notion of coherent states that goes back to Thiemann and collaborators. It is mathematically beautiful. You do this this way. You consider a delta on the graph, you define this kernel on the graph, and you let for the delta. And this gives a coherent state of the graph. Okay? If kernel coherent states. And the thing that we realized recently with together with Elena Maglia and Claudio Perini is that when you look at the classical geometry these states are picked on, it turns out to be, again, a collection of this polyhedra. So the construction doesn't speak at all about polyhedra. It turns out that they are there. Okay? So this concludes my first part. Are there questions? Otherwise, I go to the second part. Well, I use the understanding of the classical system associated to these grades of space to extract properties of the spectrum of the volume. You see,
the way the property of these grains of space was derived in the paper by Rovelli and Smolin is you start with classical general relativity, you regularize it in terms of fluxes, and then you quantize it, and you get this Hilbert space with some properties. Now, what we are finding out is that when you look at the classical limit, with given graph, you are getting this structure, this this geometry. Okay? So now I try to use the knowledge of the classical system. And I speak about the volume operator. So the volume operator defined on the graph Hilbert space is the volume of a region where a region is a subset of the graph and gets contributions from the volume of each grain of space. Now, while the volume operator for a grain of space is an operator of interfinite space, and there's a number of proposals, the first two, the original one by Rovelli and Smolin and the other by Hashtag and Lewandowski, they are built starting from this regularization and quantization of the classical volume. Now that we know also the classical limit, there's another proposal that is natural, that is, you know, that the classical limit is a polyhedron, and the natural thing is the volume of a polyhedron, or the volume of a quantum polyhedron. This is something that we have looked at. Yeah, the aim is not to look at the differences and the advantages of these proposals, but is this one. Each one of these operators has a classical limit that is a function on phase space. Okay? So I know the classical system. And moreover, in the case F equal 4, it turns out that all these proposals coincide up to an overall constant, and they give exactly the volume of a tetrahedron. So the question we started to ask today with Lagarde is, now that we know the classical system, can we learn something about the spectrum of the volume? Computing the spectrum of the volume is difficult. You have to do it numerically. So can we... The situation in loop quantum gravity up to recently was we have the quantum system, and we have to work just with this. We don't look at the... We don't expect that these grains of space have a classical interpretation. It is the opposite of the situation at the beginning of quantum mechanics, where they were really in the opposite situation when they had the classical system, the particle in a Coulomb potential, and they were interested in the quantum properties, and in fact, derived the spectrum of the hydrogen atom just looking at the classical system. In fact, Bohr and Sommerfeld did more. They even found the relativistic corrections to the spectrum of the hydrogen atom. So can we do something similar here? So the volume is a function on phase space. I'm writing it as the modulus, the square root of the modulus of the triple product of normals. And I regard this quantity as the Hamiltonian of my system. Okay? And now I look at, this is phase space for F equal 4, the one that I discussed before. And I can look at curves of constant energy in phase space, constant volume. And Planck tells us that there's a quantization condition. Cells in phase space are multiples of 2 pi h bar. So this puts a condition on this energy and on the volume spectrum. That is, if I compute this area, it has to be 2 pi h bar. So I can define a function that measures the area as a function of energy. And this is the integral dq dp of energy less than given energy is the Jacobi action integral. And we know that this is an adiabatic invariant. And Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization rule tells us that adiabatic invariants are realized in integer multiples of 2 pi h bar. So let's do this. We have, well, you can compute this function in analytic form. Here it is, S of V as a function of V. And the only thing that you have to do is to look at the intersections with these levels.
I missed maybe the previous. You were fast, and can you go back to the previous slide?
Sure.
You were a bit fast. Yeah. So where is the volume appearing? So you compute this Hamilton Jacobi functional.
Uh-huh.
So what's your definition of the volume?
Okay, the volume...
How do you relate it, this computation, to the volume?
Yes. So this is the volume of a tetrahedron.
Yeah.
The triple product of three normals, square root modulus. And is a function of the space. Okay? Now, instead of looking at the volume, it's nice to look at this object, which is under the square root. Okay? Just because in this way, yeah, it's easier to analyze. Yes?
Yeah, are you still keeping the areas fixed?
Can you repeat the question?
Are you still keeping the areas fixed?
Yes. The areas
so
are
there is one space for each set of areas.
Exactly. So I'm getting the spectrum for each choice of spins of areas as a function of the spins.
So basically as a function of the angles.
Exactly. Okay.
So S of E is supposed to be the volume, or no, you're looking for the quantization condition. Yes.
Right. So the volume is V, and what I'm calling E, if you take the modulus of the square root of E, this is the volume. Okay? The volume, yes.
Yeah, so just a question, what's the strategy? We're not interested in the physically in the areas being fixed, or maybe
Yeah, so the idea is, if I, so
When you diagonalize the volume in full loop quantum gravity, you always do this. It commutes with the area, so you block diagonalize it, and then you diagonalize each block.
Right.
It's a finite dimensional problem.
Here I'm doing the same. The nice thing is that I get analytic formulae that depend on J, so I have knowledge about all the spectrum. Okay? So here there's an, this goes back to a discussion of Einstein together with Ehrenfest about having a pendulum and changing slowly the length of the pendulum. What is that remains invariant under this slow adiabatic transformation? This is the quantity that remains invariant. So what have the Hamiltonian, you can think of the Hamiltonian with a parameter that depends slowly on time. And you ask, what remains invariant when I change slowly this parameter? It's this function. It is an adiabatic invariant. And their idea, their motivation was Planck has found that the harmonic oscillator is quantized in this way. Now, suppose that I start from the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator and I go slowly changing the Hamiltonian to some other Hamiltonians. If the spectrum is discrete, if the allowed values of the energy are these ones, these are discrete, so with a slow continuous transformation, I should not destroy them. So there has to be something that is invariant. This was the argument that Ehrenfest gives. Okay? Okay, so adiabatic invariant, I require that there are multiples of 2 pi. That is, I get these levels and look at the intersections, and these are the, this is the energy, and its square root modulus is the volume. So you get these points. So here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 intersections is dimension 6, Hilbert space, and it's these 3 points. And this is an approximation, right? This is a semi-classical approximation. So you can ask, how good is it? You can compare it with the analytical one. Well, analytical. The exact one that you do numerically, diagonalizing a huge matrix. So, and you get these circles. So just so you can appreciate how the accuracy of this approximation. Even the small eigenvalues are very accurate.
F and a fixed choice of the areas.
Yes.
But are you showing us a good case? Is the matching?
Yeah, we have investigated many cases, and it works very well in all the cases that we have looked at. Yes. So I'm here I'm plotting not just one. I'm varying the spins, the areas. It is varying also the dimension of the Hilbert space. So this 6 is the spectrum with a certain choice of areas, and now I'm plotting many of them to compare them, to have enough data. Okay? And there's much more that can be done. We have a bunch of results together with Alagar from this. That is, you can look at the period of these orbits, right? The period is the slope of this curve. And it has a simple expression, okay? And in fact, you will see that it goes to a constant for large energy, for large volume. That means that the spectrum of the volume is equispaced of large eigenvalue, something that we had noticed numerically, and we were looking for an explanation of this. And in fact, the spacing is 2 pi over the period that that one has to expect. This is Bohr correspondence principle. The transition between the levels is the period of the classical system. But it goes to a constant. It goes linearly here, so the derivative goes to a constant. That means that if you start from a very large eigenvalue and you look at the first largest eigenvalues, you get this spacing that is approximately constant, and you can compute the corrections too. Okay, right. So if you use the period of this Hamiltonian, then there's that dependence on the maximum volume, and it's still a constant and depends on this maximum volume. Right.
Is it V or V squared?
It's V squared. Well, the question that I find most interesting is about the volume gap. This is where I want to see what happens. And this approximation is extremely good also for small eigen values. And what you have to look is at the behavior of this Jacobi function, this Jacobi integral at small e. And we find this behavior that we can confirm geometrically. Okay? And we have some other results that are not coming. So are there questions on this second part?
This is all with four faces.
Yes.
I think the issue with the volume gap has been for a large number of faces.
Yes, 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 I agree. So this is for four faces, and here everything is done analytically. For a larger number of faces, the face space is not two-dimensional anymore. It's more complicated. We are looking at it, and what we expect is a quantum chaos behavior, and there are other things that can be predicted with semi-classical methods, like the density of states, the density of eigen values. But it's something to be worked out. Maybe we can extract information on the volume gap even for larger.
So it's in the volume gap is what Skinning like the product of G1, G4 for the
up to now. So I have a comment on this. I don't have analytical results, but we have done a lot of simulations, so numerical evidence, let's see.
Yeah. All the evidence is that if you consider the volume of a polyhedron and the volume of a quantum polyhedron, the volume gap is the evidence is that it comes from four faces and all the spins 1/2. We haven't found any eigenvalue that is below this one. Now, if you look at the Hershberger-Lewandowski volume, David Reidaut has worked on this a lot, numerically and analytically with Johannes Brunemann, and they see that there's a sequence that goes to zero, that is evidence for accumulating point and no volume gap. Okay, so they are considering the Hershberger-Lewandowski volume operator, and this operator has some signs in the definition that come from the dependence of this operator on the differentiable structure of the manifold at the node. Now, these signs that appear give cancellations that are most probably the source of this accumulating point. Here, there are no cancellations because we are just computing the volume of a polyhedron. So if you want, you can split the polyhedron into tetrahedra and sum the parts. So the guess is that the volume gap is the one of 1/2, 1/2, 1/2, 1/2 that we can compute diagonalizing a 2x2 matrix. And it's for the volume of a quantum polyhedron. I think that this is important. We have the opportunity of having a theory with no Transplanckian degrees of freedom, so we have to look at it in detail. Is there a volume gap or not?
I suppose it's still true for
okay.
A big region. You tell me if I take big spins on external spins, then I'm going to have a volume gap, which is a linear. Which is a linear function.
It's very simple.
No, I mean that's the result, but yeah. Physically.
Why? Ah, physically.
Maybe because you're just adding this extra scale and then you're scaling.
Physically. Well, the only physical argument that I have is let's look at the period of these orbits and let's see how it behaves. And it gets larger here. In a larger period means a larger volume gap. This is my qualitative understanding of this behavior. This is not a straight line, but it's straight here. And we know how to describe its behavior here, just expanding these elliptic functions.
Let me see if there's another question that you can address. So there's an issue of what is the scaling or the fractal dimension on a manifold.
Yes.
And you could ask, as you scale the area, say, how does the number of states scale? Or as you scale the volume, how does the number of states scale?
I see. Yeah, I've asked to Leonardo.
Yeah,
I've not thought about this, but you're right. So the number of states depends on the areas, and one can ask how it depends on them. Yeah. Thank you. It's a good thing to look at. Okay. So maybe there's enough time. I'd like to tell you about this third part, which is about black hole entropy, and uses the methods I've been speaking about. And this is another situation where this granular structure is expected to be important. Yeah, it's not the granular structure of the space, but the granular structure of the surface, the horizon of the black hole. Okay? So outline of the third part. I describe black hole entropy in terms of shapes of the horizon, and then show how quantum gravity provides a physical cutoff for these horizon degrees of freedom, these shapes, in terms of a tessellated membrane. And then there's a counting to be done, this is physical mechanics, and I show how this counting can be done now using ideas coming from polymer physics. So, black hole entropy is a well-developed subject in quantum gravity. There's a large body of work, starting with Ashtekar, Baitz, Skorici, and Krasnov, and more recently, Engel, Nui, Peretz, and Franzetti. And the presence of a black hole is coded into boundary conditions. Boundary conditions, isolated horizon boundary conditions. And this amounts to having a boundary theory that is an SU2 Chern-Simons theory with punctures. And these are the quantum degrees of freedom on the horizon that one wants to count. And the counting amounts to compute the number of states in a certain interplanar space, dimension of this hyperspace. So these are quantum degrees of freedom. There's a thing I've been asking many times. Are these purely quantum degrees of freedom, or they have a classical analog, a semi-classical analog? Are they there already at the classical level? Okay, so what I'll do in this part of the talk is not use the full machinery of loop quantum gravity. The counting I'll do is equivalent to this SU2-Chern-Simons theory calculation, and is semi-classical as a description. As we all know, black holes have thermodynamic properties, and the question is, what is their statistical mechanics origin? It is, what are the microstates that are responsible for heat exchanges of the black hole with the surroundings? And there's an old idea that I find interesting and is due, I understand it's due to Sorkin, Raphael Sorkin. And the idea is that the microstates are there already at the classical level and are fluctuations of the shape of the horizon. You consider Schwarzschild, it has its shape, it's spherically symmetric, but in presence of, for instance, a planet goes around, you get a bulge on the horizon, it changes the shape of the horizon, and in a thermodynamic situation when there's a gas outside, you have fluctuations, thermal fluctuations, and in a quantum setting, quantum fluctuations. And this resonates with another idea, another old idea that is called the membrane paradigm, was started by Thibaut d'Amour. It is a description of the physics outside a black hole in terms of a fictitious membrane with physical properties, mechanical and thermal properties. Yes.
Okay, but you didn't mention it.
Yeah.
So Jim York's idea was that you could represent the horizon of the dynamics of the horizon of the black hole by a virtual system, which was the set of its quasi-normal modes.
Yes.
Can you make contact with that?
Yeah. I don't know. I've been trying to read all your papers. To figure out where the idea comes from. So there's a beautiful paper by York where I think he is the first to speak about these quasi-normal modes, and he mentions also shapes of the horizon, but not in the same way that is discussed in a proceeding of a conference by Sorkin. So I don't know. I guess that this idea has been around for a while.
Well, the particular idea of Jim Europe was that you would get a good approximation to counting the states of the dynamics of the horizon by looking at the quasi-normal modes, in the same sense that Planck had the idea that you could represent the quantum thermodynamics, quantum statistical mechanics of a electromagnetic field by a set of oscillators, which were discrete and had discrete properties. So it's I don't know who was talking to who and what was the origin. But my question was not about this. Uh-huh. My question was whether you can actually make contact with the quasi-normal modes because there's still that enigmatic paper of Olaf Dreyer and I forget the name of the guy in Israel, making contact between the black hole entropy and the emergency parameter and the motion of quasi-normal modes.
Yes. So the answer is that I hope that there is a relation. I'm not using this relation here, I'm just counting states. Nevertheless, at some point, when you look into the test, it's a comment that I can make on it later when I look at the probability distribution. Okay, this is classical, and then there's a perturbative quantum field theory calculation by Maggiore, where he looks at small fluctuations of the membrane, and compute the entropy of these fluctuations, and defines that it's proportional to the area, as you may expect. But the coefficient in front of it depends on the cutoff that you are introducing, and when you remove the cutoff, the entropy diverges. So, my expectation is that through quantum gravity is providing a physical cutoff, a very specific one, and what I want to show is how the counting is done with the cutoff that comes from quantum gravity. So, physical cutoff provided by loop quantum gravity is the same classical and a quantum description. The quantum description is the one that comes from this execution sinus theory calculation. But from what I told you in the first part of the talk, there's a semi-classical understanding of this, that is, you get a tessellated surface with n faces of given area and given normals that satisfy this closure condition. And once you give this data, you determine uniquely this surface, this specific surface. And now we want to count them. So I have to tell you what are the microstates. So let me first identify the microstate. I look at Schwarzschild black hole, and what I'll fix as an ensemble is I only fix the total area. Okay? And now the microstates, well, they don't need to be spherically symmetric. As the gas in this room, the microstates are not translationally invariant. So what I have to do is to count the accessible shapes of the tessellated horizon. That is different intrinsic and extrinsic geometries. And these are, and the configurations are determined by this data. Okay, so I call the number of distinguishable states with fixed total area, W, and the entropy is the logarithm of W. So this way I post the statistical mechanics problem. Now I do the counting. What is this total number of configurations? It's a standard statistical mechanics counting. Yes.
The number of faces?
No, I'm not going to fix it. I'll show you in a moment how I fix this. So I could do the counting. It's complicated counting. I have to count the shapes in this data. And I understand from people in statistical mechanics that there's a standard strategy to do this kind of countings. It is look for an equivalent system where the counting has already been done. And it turns out that there is one, and it is a polymer, a closed polymer chain. So how, where does it come from? You have this tessellated surface that is described in terms of a set of vectors that sum up to zero. Okay, these are my data. Now I'm taking the first one, then the second, the third, and I know that they close, so this chain goes back here.
So what I have to count is the number of configurations, conformations of this polynomial.
Sorry, how do you order them? I mean, the right-hand side is an order.
Yes, yes.
The left-hand side, there's no
yes.
numbering on the face.
Yes. In the counting, the ordering is taken into account, so it's not important how I order them.
What do you mean?
I take into account the orderings when I do the statistical mechanics calculation. I do the calculation first for an ordering. So if you prefer, when you look at polymer physics, you give the monomers, the content of the chain. Okay, you compute the entropy that is conformational entropy. Okay. Now, as Valentin was asking, are you fixing the number of these leaks? What are you fixing? So when there's a part of the calculation that is about conformations, and a part of the calculation that has to do with unfreezing all the degrees of freedom, that is like considering the entropy of making these polymers. Okay, so there are two parts in the calculation. Yes?
Yeah. Let me ask a more specific question about the relationship. If I consider two of your tessellated surfaces that differ just by a global rigid rotation, do you count them as separate?
No. No, they are indistinguishable for me. Okay.
So when you say taking into account, there is much more information in the geometry of the surface. For example, who are the neighbors? Who are the edges that correspond to the neighbors?
Yes.
Is that somehow coded in?
Yeah, you give this data, and from this data you can derive which of these two normals correspond to nearby faces.
How do you do that?
It's complicated. It's a reconstruction procedure that we have developed. The interesting thing is that what Minkowski theorem tells you is that you get this data and there's a unique one.
It's fair to say there's no reconstruction. I mean, it's a mathematical. There's this existence theorem. You can do it.
Yeah.
Nobody knows how to do it.
You can do it case by case. There's an algorithm to do this.
You know you can do it. But
you know you can do it, and you can do it numerically.
Roughly speaking, it's a complicated enough problem to fit the pieces together that if there's a solution, there's a unique solution.
Yes.
But it means that those which are very symmetric, where, for example, it's all squares or all triangles, are going to be very, are going to...
Okay, so the ones that give the most important contribution are the ones where each facet has six sides.
Okay.
You can derive it analytically and you can check it with simulations and it goes very quickly to six facets. So the idea here is that we are computing the entropy. What we're interested in is what is the most important contribution. Then there are also situations where all the entropy is in a corner, but this doesn't really contribute to the entropy that much. Okay, so the map between the two systems, number of facets, number of monomers, areas and normals, it is length and directions of the monomers. The closure condition here is the fact that this is a closed chain. Here we have a physical cutoff that is the quantum of area, discrete spectrum of the area. While in polymer physics, the physical cutoff is monomer chemistry. And here we are interested in the entropy. Well, here the entropy is known. You open any polymer physics book, for instance, Degen, beautiful book on polymers, and in the first section of the first chapter, you find that the entropy is proportional to the length of the polymer. And when you translate it back, the length is the sum of the length of monomers, but each one has length that is the area, so the sum of the areas, and this gives you the area law. Okay, and then you can look at average configurations. And the first thing that you learn in polymer physics is that the average configuration is crumpled. And when you translate it back, it means that these normals are randomly distributed. That is, the average shape is spherically symmetric.
So I'm not putting it there, that this is Schwarzschild. I'm getting that, in average, the configuration is spherically symmetric. Well, in polymer physics... Yes.
Yes. Yes. So how do you quantify it? That is, can you define a spherically parameter?
Yes. Yes. It corresponds here to how far you go in random work.
But in that sense, so here, when you define
it? Yeah, you can define it both here and here.
So what do you define as a...
So let's define it here. It's easy. It has a name. It's called radius of gyration in polymer physics. That is the maximal extension from here to here. Okay? And you know that it goes like the square root of the number of steps. Mm-hmm. Okay? And when you translate it here, it gives an estimate of how oblate is this.
So, but in this language, what is it? Is it like the ratio of the volume over the area?
No.
What is it in terms of geometrical entities?
It's the average of the sum of the of this vector square. It's just like in random work, how far you go in a random work.
Now in random work it's clear.
Yeah. And then you translate it back.
Yeah, I'm asking here, does it have a geometrical meaning?
This is next slide. Yeah, okay, so, well, if you look at the calculation in loop quantum gravity in terms of chain sinus theory, it's somewhat involved. And there you can compute more than the area law, also the quantum corrections. And it turns out that the quantum corrections are of this kind. They are logarithmic in the area with a coefficient in front of it that is minus 3 alpha. And it turns out that you get exactly this same behavior and same coefficient also in the calculation with near horizon conformal field theory. The point that has been conjectured that this is independent of a specific physical cutoff at the Planck scale. Karip has pointed out that this may be universal. So let's look at what happens in polymer physics. Well, there is known that there are corrections to the length, and the coefficient in front of the logarithmic correction is universal. It depends only on the classical universality of this polymer. And for a closed chain, it's minus 3 alpha. And to show this is extremely easy. You can do it in one blackboard or in one slide. So I want to show it. It's really easy. It's really interesting how it happens. So I'm separating the problem in two steps. I first fix the areas, the number of faces and the area of each face, and then take into account also this contribution. So this is the number of configurations for fixed areas. So there's a part, this semi-classical has to do with the length of them, and a part that has to do with the conformation, with the directions, conformation of the polymer. And this is the condition that tells you that this is a closed polymer. And now to do this calculation, you use two standard tricks. The first is to write the delta in Fourier transform, integral NDP. And the third is to introduce occupation numbers. It is the number of faces, the number of monomers of given length. Okay? And assume that these occupation numbers are large by doing statistical, classical statistical mechanics. Okay? And in the limit when these are large, well, to start, you can do this integral. You can compute this integral. And for n large, this is a Gaussian, and we know how to integrate a Gaussian. You just get 1 over the square root of the determinant of the Hessian. We are in 3 dimensions, so you get the minus 3 half. This is the minus 3 half of the logarithmic correction. While this term in front of it is the one that gives the area law. Okay, I'm going a bit ahead, but I wanted to show you where the minus 3 half comes from. It comes from the condition that it closes. Okay, so this is... for a given number of faces of given areas. Well, in fact, I've gone to occupation numbers, so I have to be careful because when I give you the occupation numbers, there are indistinguishable configurations. I can exchange two spins that have the same value and the configuration doesn't change. I have to take it into account. Okay? So this is the number of states as a function of occupation numbers. And at equilibrium, the equilibrium distribution is the one that extremizes the entropy with a given condition that chooses my ensemble. And here, my ensemble, I'm choosing it saying that the average area is given. So I'm implementing it as a Lagrange multiplier with a constraint. And this multiplier plays the role of chemical potential for the number of facets. So I extremize it, I get this distribution, substitute it back, and you get the entropy that is area law plus corrections.
Star and gamma?
Yes. So the gamma is a fundamental constant of the theory, is the Mirzi parameter, something to be measured.
Gamma is a Mirzi.
Yes.
Somehow Mirzi got into the game here.
How it enters? Because it enters the scale of this granular structure. Okay? It tells you how many degrees of freedom fit into this area. Okay? While mu is my chemical potential, and I have to determine it requiring this condition, it turns out to be this number. You solve it numerically. Okay? While this value of gamma is the one that you need if you want to have 1/4 here. We are not predicting the 1/4 of the area. This is a different problem. Okay? So what are we getting? This result is known. This is the same result you get from the Chern-Simons theory calculation. The nice thing is that we are not making all these approximations in the very end of a long calculation. We are making them at the very beginning. Same, large classical black hole. So let's identify first the semi-classical states, the microstates. There's something else that we gain, that is the probability distribution and the average number of faces. It is area of some Planck scale area that you determine. And so you can derive the amount of spin 1/2 faces, spin 1, spin 2. There are large ones are suppressed exponentially, as you may expect. If you have one that is larger, you have fewer configurations. And now, I don't know, I've not been looking at quasi-normal modes, I've not used them, but I understand that this idea of Olaf Dreyer works very well if you have spin 1. Spin 1 is dimension 2j plus 1, it is 3, logarithm of 3 that appears in quasi-normal modes formula. And yeah, there are all the spins. We are seeing even how many of them are of a certain spin. Yeah. You have the distribution, you can compute the average spin. Well, it turns out to be 1.003. I don't know if it tells you something. If I think I want to look at it in more detail. It may be interesting. Okay. Not yet. So it is turning out that it is the average spin, not the single spin that is contributing. Yeah, we should talk about this. I really hope, this is counting of states. I'm not telling you why I'm counting these states. Or, well, I've been telling you, if you start with the full quantum gravity calculation, it tells you that you have to count these states, and I'm doing it semi-classically. But there may be another starting point that is, I understand the membrane paradigm, I understand quasi-normal modes, and this tells me that I have to count these states. So I don't know about if there is this relation, but I think that I want to look at it. So, but yet, still, this result is known, it's not new. Can we use this idea to get something that has not already been done? Something more than this. But I guess you understood the strategy now. It has worked for section 1, for section 2. Let's look at section 3 of my book on polymer physics. That is where what happens to this when you stretch a polymer. If you stretch a polymer, what's happening? Well, you know, when you stretch the polymer, the number of configurations goes down. And this is, in fact, the origin of the elasticity of rubber. And moreover, you cannot stretch a polymer more than its length, so there's an extremal situation. So the question is there something like this in black hole physics? And it turns out that the angular momentum behaves this way, that there's a bound, an extremal bound. The angular momentum has to be below mass square. And moreover, if you look at the entropy, you fix the mass and you raise the angular momentum, you find that the entropy goes down. So this is qualitative. Let's look at it more quantitatively. So what happens to the number of configurations for a polymer? When you stretch it, the entropy goes down, in a way that is Gaussianly suppressed with the stretching. Okay? So when you take the logarithm of this, this is for small stretching. When you take the logarithm of this, you get the length law minus a term that is quadratic in the stretching. Okay? And you can look at the average configuration. So you were asking before, if it's not crumpled, if it's not spherically symmetric, do we have an estimate of how much spherically symmetric it is? So here, I'm giving you the stretching, and I find that the average configuration is stretched this way. And now, I have this stretched configuration, and I can go back and give this picture. And what I have is that there's a number of them that has a sum that is pointing in this direction, and another number that is pointing in this other direction. So when you reconstruct the tessellated surface, you obtain this oblate thing, this ellipsoid. And it turns out to be ellipsoidal exactly as the shape of the membrane of a Kerber coil, at least for small angular momentum and small stretching. And this becomes quantitative when you compare this formula that you find in polymer physics books to this formula that doesn't come from quantum gravity. I mean, you find it in black hole physics books. It's the entropy for a truly rotating black hole. It's called Smart formula. And they really look similar. So there's not yet a description of the entropy of rotating black holes or slowly rotating black holes in quantum gravity. This is something that is missing. So what I'm saying is, this is suggesting that there's a direction that we can try. It looks promising. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, what happens? So I've been looking into this. So there's an objection that, there's not an objection, but something that has been worrying me about the calculation of the black hole entropy in quantum gravity. That is, you fix the ensemble giving the total area. Now, this works if you're just speaking about Schwarzschild. But if you're interested in Kerr, then you want to look at how the entropy changes when you vary the mass and the angular momentum independently. So we should be able to identify the ensemble giving the mass and the angular momentum. And we are not yet able to do this in quantum gravity, but at some point we should be able to identify what is the mass. It should be some function on the shape of this membrane. So we should look at it. There may be some version of the Comar mass that can be implemented here. So I agree. Yeah, I have the length. Yeah, I have the mass square. Mass square is the area if this is Schwarzschild. If it is not Schwarzschild, it's mass square. And this is why I'm saying this is pointing to a direction. There's something to understand here, I guess. Okay, so to summarize this third part, quantum gravity provides a specific physical cutoff for horizon degrees of freedom, quantum shapes of the horizon. The counting of horizon microstates can be mapped into an analog statistical mechanics problem, conformations of closed polymer chains. The area law and the log corrections are reproduced. And moreover, the construction suggests a new way to describe Kerr black holes in quantum gravity. And I think I'll stop here. Thank you very much for your attention.
Communication with Mr. Valinda and this way of looking at things at all. I mean, since you're both polymer people now, you know all about it.
Yeah, good question. So I've not been speaking with him. I know about these ideas. I don't know if there's a relation.
May I make a suggestion? Take a pilgrimage to the Netherlands. Sit at his feet and see what happens. I would guess he'd be very interested.
Okay. Thank you for the suggestion.
I don't know. I don't know. It's other people have questions. I have another one. And you're almost at the classical limit. And if I think, which is the only way I think about this problem, the classical gravity, pure gravity in Lagrangian form, in first order formalism, has Einstein term, cosmological term, maybe an Euler term, and so on. And then there's the Holtz term and other stuff, maybe. And the coefficient of the Holtz term is 1 over gamma, which is a coupling constant. Gamma has a history which doesn't, gravity, which goes beyond that, of course. But if I just look at it from that point of view, and I set gamma equal to infinity, that leaves the Holtz term and all the CP violin stuff in pure gravity behind. But it doesn't leave Mr. Bekenstein, Mr. Hawking, and all those people that developed from a gravity picture who didn't ever consider the CP violin part of pure gravity. So I would have thought that there would be a description of the black hole entropy and all of that, which would be robust in the limit of gamma going to infinity. And I don't see it in your formula.
Yeah, I see the point. So I see the point. So I guess the answer is, gamma is entering more than one way, not just as a term in the action, but also as the scale or the granularity of the quantum reality. So you have to ask, what happens if I take the limit of large gamma or small gamma in quantum gravity, and you just destroy the theory? Yes. Yeah, large gamma is the semi-classical limit, but means also that if you... Okay, yeah, small...
Limit, in a sense.
Yeah.
Small gamma, what?
Yeah, small gamma is like a semi-classical limit there.
Gamma is just a coupling constant in a classical action. Mm-hmm. There's no quantum in it.
Right. No, there's no, but it appears as a quantum thing.
Yeah, so
it appears in the formal structure in the Hamiltonian language of gravity literature because it's in the commutation relations. For I don't know whether it's essential reasons or historic reasons.
No, it's essential.
That's part of the question of it.
I think it's essential.
Yeah. Well, what I understand is that gamma. Oh, yes, good.
I mean, it's basically expressing in the extreme case. Gamma also, I mean, to think carefully about what you're saying, you should remember that gamma has a real part and an imaginary part.
No, not in my world. That gives a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian and a non-Hermitian Lagrangian, and you may want to consider that, but I think it's to start talking about quantum mechanics with unitary evolution non-Hermitian Lagrangian. So gamma is real in my world.
Fine. I misspoke. There's another way to say what I want to say, but anyway. Gamma. Gamma expresses the fact that if that's a purely left handed connection, commutes with components of itself and does not commute with components of the purely right handed connection.
Life is complicated. What else is new?
Well,
my understanding is that, as you point out in the action, there's a term 1 over gamma, actually, I have 1 over gamma g Newton. Okay, it's the term in
front of the topological part, the Nyan part. Yeah, but it appears also somewhere else. So it it's playing two different roles. One that appears in the dynamics, and we see it in spinform models. Spinform models, if you change gamma, you are changing the dynamics. And appears separately in a discrete spectrum of operators. It's appearing in a different way. In the spectrum of operator, you are always getting gamma L plus square, never gamma alone. While in the dynamics, you get gamma alone. Okay? So
If I have to understand this as fundamental constants of the theory that I have to measure experimentally, well, it appears that there's something that appears in the dynamics, in the action, that is the one that you are pointing out, the one over gamma that appears in the action, and there's something else, depends on gamma, this gamma L prime squared, that appears in front, that tells you the scale of these quantum geometry effects. And here, I'm not using the dynamics. I've never used the dynamics, actually. I've been speaking only about how many degrees of freedom fit into this area. And gamma tells me, gives me the scale of this physical cutoff. I agree. I see your point. So my answer is gamma is playing two roles here. One is the coupling to CP violating terms in the dynamics, and another one that is much more like H-bar. It's appearing everywhere there's H-bar. That is, it's telling me what is the spacing between these discrete eigenvalues. And then if you take limits, you can still do classical general relativity. You can still derive black hole entropy. But then when you ask, where does entropy come from? What are the microstates? You have infinitely many. You don't have any cutoff. Yes, maybe.
We have the commutation relations, which are gamma. Those commutation relations which have gamma term. And when you renormalize just by constant factors, the fields in the appropriate way, the gamma disappears in performance. Mm-hmm. So it could be very simple.
Okay. Other questions?
So you put that very large black holes here. Can you also use this language of polymers to look at quantum black holes in some way?
Well, if I consider a quantum polymer, yes, it's equivalent. So for a small black hole, I cannot use the semi-classical approximation to count states, I have to count the dimension interference space. Okay? So I need to do the quantum calculation, there are quantum corrections. And if you're looking for an analog system, you can look at a quantum polymer where these spins are quantized and not gaining much. In fact, the calculation, yeah, the exact calculation, we know how to do.
Questions? Let's end for the day.
Today.